وما كنا لنهتدي لولا أن هدانا الله والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء وسيد المرسلين سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم محمد. وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين لا سيما مولانا وسيدي صاحب الأسر والزمان روحي وأرواح العالمين له الفداء وأجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف ولعنته دائمة على أعدائهم ومنكر فضائلهم إلى الآن إلى قيام يوم الدين. أما بعد، رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي. So as we continue in our discussion about knowing the Imam of our time, Imam al-Hujjah, أجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف. Last week, for those who were here, recall, we spoke briefly about, as an introduction to the Imam, about his lineage, his background, his family, and a few of the areas that we're going to delve into basically from today's discussion onwards. Today I want to look at the topic of the four representatives of the Imam. So we know that, as we mentioned last week, after the death of the 11th Imam, so the 5th Imam, the 12th Imam rather, was born in the year 255. His father, the 11th Imam, he leaves this world out 5 years later. And then from 260 after the Hijra, for a period of about 63 years or so, the 12th Imam goes into what we looked at last week was the minor occultation, the Ghaybat al-Sughra. In this time, as we see on the screen, one of the things that was happening is that there had to be a way for the 12th Imam, the Imam of the time, of that particular time, and obviously for the time to come, to connect with the community, right? With the first 11 Imams, they obviously were physically amongst the people. People could walk to their homes. People had a level of interaction with the first 11 Imams. The 12th Imam, as we've talked about in the past, things were very different. And Allah basically, obviously, as we know, has a specific wisdom why He determined, and we looked at that last week, of why the 12th Imam would have to go into a minor and a major occultation. What happens in the time of the minor occultation, so that initial 63 years, is that the 12th Imam had four deputies, had four representatives. Not at one time, they came one after the other. So the first one would come, fulfill his responsibility when he would pass away. The 12th Imam would then appoint a second representative. And this went on for four individuals. So these were four representatives, again, directly appointed by our Imam, to be a connection between the Shias during the minor occultation in that 63-year period. So they were known as the Nawab al-Arba or the Nawab al-Khas, either the four representatives, you'll see this term in the hadith, in the literature, or the special deputies of the Imam. These, when you look in the history, I don't want to delve on their historical aspect, but these are basically four individuals who were very well known to the Ahlul Bayt, right? They weren't just random people were selected. These are very close companions of the 10th, 11th Imam. These are people who were obviously very trustworthy. They were known to be the followers of the Ahlul Bayt. They were known for their strict code of conduct, for their respect of the religion. And so these were people that the Imam chose that they would be the link between the community. Just to give you some of the details about them. We see that the first one, Uthman ibn Sa'id al-Amri, he was for about 5 years as the deputy of our 12th Imam. He was again the first deputy, and he actually was by profession, he would sell ghee, he would sell oil. And one of the reasons why that becomes important, when you study more deeper into these individuals, is that they had to have a cover for what they were doing, right? Because you couldn't necessarily just walk to the house of the Imam, knock at the door, you know, and bring khums money, ask questions, get, you know, replies. So what each of these individuals would do, and the first one began this tradition, is his job, his full-time job was an oil seller, right? He'd sell ghee and oil and these kinds of things. But he would go to the home of the Imam pretending to be just an average worker, right? Selling and buying things. And so he would be welcomed into the house of the Imam because the Bani Abbas, they figured he was just an average, you know, person working on the streets and selling things. And so he would basically hide money even in jars or in containers of oil and take it to the Imam. Or he would hide money and take it to the Imam in that fashion. And so he used his profession as a way to basically further the religious and the political, you know, to an extent, role of the Shia community in Samarra at that time. Eventually, he passes away in 265, and his son becomes the second of the four deputies, Muhammad ibn Uthman. And again, he was very trustworthy. He was the son of this first representative. And so the Imam had him to be again that second link between the community. I should mention here that the first two, they had a bit of an easier job, we can say. So when our historians speak about this minor occultation, they talk about the fact that the first two representatives, they were a bit more, we can say, freer. There was a bit more, you know, leeway in terms of what they were able to do, what they were able to get away with, the Bani Abbas. But it seems that after the time of the second representative, the political circumstances in Baghdad and Samarra, where the Bani Abbas were obviously stationed, became a bit more difficult, especially for the Shia community. And so the first two, they had a bit more mobility, more freedoms. But as that Ghaybat al-Sughra continued, it became more and more difficult for these individuals to freely interact. But we should keep in mind, as the historians mentioned, that the 12th Imam, as we talked about last week, he wasn't hiding necessarily in a, you know, in the basement in Samarra. He had limited mobility. He would go to Hajj. He would go to Medina, for example. He was in Iraq at that time. So he had some connection to Shia, right? Those who knew the Imam, and certain companions had physically seen the Imam, the 11th Imam, for example, before he died. He allowed people to come and see his son. And even in the minor occultation, there were limited interaction with some of the Shias of the community. Eventually, the second one passes away, and in 269 to 280, Hussein ibn Ruh al-Nawbakhti takes over his role as the deputy of the 12th Imam. Again, he is a very trustworthy individual. And I'm not going into too much of the details. You can read more about these individuals in some of the books and their biographies of what activities they were involved with. Just want to give us these names so we know who the representatives are. And he obviously had quite a long opportunity to serve the Imam at that time. And then the fourth and the final deputy, Ali ibn Muhammad al-Samari, comes on the scene. And obviously he has one of the longest actually sort of roles as the representative of the 12th Imam. And obviously his role becomes important because with his death would basically end this representation of the Imam. And this is important for us also to keep aware of, that with the death of the fourth representative, there are no more representatives of the 12th Imam. You know, sometimes we use this term for our Maraja Taqlid, that they're Nawab or Naibs of the Imam, but they are not directly appointed by our 12th Imam. They're general representation, but they're not specifically representing our 12th Imam. So we have to be sure that we don't get confused by the two. Right? The Maraja definitely have a status. They are scholars. We follow their rulings. We refer to them for religious, political, social issues. But they are not directly appointed by our 12th Imam. And obviously with that said, people sometimes, for some strange reason, tend to think that our Maraja meet the 12th Imam on a regular basis. This also is something that we have to understand is not acceptable to state, even, or, you know, even if people, and we see a hadith that people who claim even to see the 12th Imam, as the hadith tell us, that we have to basically deny their statement. So there is nobody who today can claim on earth that they are representatives of the 12th Imam. In fact, there is even a group, I had talked about them in the past, in Iraq, who actually claim that their leader is the son of the 12th Imam. And he's actually developed a following. They have a very active website in 12 or 15 languages. They, you know, they have a complete different ideology, really, about the Shia and the 12th Imam. They believe that their leader is the son of the Imam, and that he basically is in charge while the Imam is in the occultation. Obviously, we don't, the mainstream Shia sects don't agree with this individual, because again, that official deputyship was sealed with the death of the fourth representative. There can be general guidance from community members, from the scholars, from the Maraja, but there is no way or room in our ideology for a son of the Imam, for example, or somebody to claim to be a member of the family of the 12th Imam, to now come forth and basically claim authority or people to pay allegiance to that individual. So just a few points about this period of the minor occultation. One is that not only was the 12th Imam away from the sight of the masses during this ghaiba, during the occultation period, but also we believe that the four representatives, they weren't in ghaiba, in occultation, but they basically worked in a stealth form of way, basically trying to circumvent the government of the time to make sure that the Bani Abbas would not be aware of the 12th Imam or of their own activities and dealings. And again, this becomes very important to keep in mind, even for our day and age, right? That sometimes we ask for a bit too much information from our Maraja, let's say, right? And that can sometimes put our own system, we can say, in a difficult place. So as we see with the 12th Imam, he ensured that his representatives were kept under the radar. They didn't draw the attention of the government of the time, right? And so as believers, we also have to appreciate the way that they were working was in a way that they were training us how to deal with things in the Akhir Zaman. Because just as at that time there were difficulties on the Shia, we know that even in today's day and age, and as we get, you know, closer and closer to whenever the Zuhur occurs, there will be more and more challenges for the Shias. And so perhaps this was a way of the Imam training us for, you know, those who will come later on to be able to safeguard many of the, we can say, the secrets of the Ahlul Bayt, things that others don't necessarily have to know about the way that we do things within our community and our society. We also see that in this time, the 12th Imam would encourage these four representatives to work with certain companions to, in a way, infiltrate the Bani Abbas government. And there are examples of this, because normally the Ahlul Bayt would always shun their followers from working with the government of the time, right? Even in our day and age, we know that certain professions within the governments of our secular systems can actually be considered to be impermissible. There are exceptions, obviously, to the rule. And even we saw that at the time of the Imams, they were very careful, right? We'd have companions who would come to some of the Imams. And one of the Imams, for example, I think it was the 6th Imam or the 8th Imam, he would tell this companion that, I like everything about you, your akhlaq, your aqaid, everything is great, but I have one problem with you. And the companion would tell the Imam, what's the problem? And the Imam would say that you work with a non-Islamic government. You're working with the Bani Abbas, for example. And the Imam would tell him that the way that you can redeem yourself, the kafara for you working with the government, is to see if you can give benefit to the Shias, right? If there are tax collectors that are coming to take more tax from the Shia, try to deflect them. Try to do things to protect the believing community. So the Imams would not always encourage their Shias to work with the government, but at the time of the 12th Imam, it seems, according to some of the narrations, that there was limited influence, and that was obviously for the greater good of the community. Also, we see that these representatives ensured that doubts and confusions about the Imam were removed from the masses. So what would happen is that there would be, obviously, and this has happened really throughout the ages, through the time of the Prophet and the Imams, that people always had confusions about the religion, right? Even when the Prophet passed away, you know, when you study the history, some people claim that the Prophet didn't die. He was like Prophet Musa who went to the mountain. And there are examples at the time of almost every Imam, right? The 6th Imam, we know that there was a split between the Ismaili and the Ithnashiri community. After the death of the 7th Imam, there was another split. Groups that believed that that Imam who died was, for example, gone up to the heavens and he would come back. And so at the time of the 12th Imam, because keep in mind, right, like people have been used to having a physical Imam with them. And now all of a sudden, after, you know, 260 years, now this ghaiba begins and now there's no direct connection. So people began to think maybe different things, began to, and there were people who claimed to be the Imam, who claimed to be the 12th Imam, like one of the brothers of the 11th Imam, Ja'far al-Kadhab, as he's known, he claimed to be the Imam after Imam Askari alayhi salam. So these Naibs were also trying to clear the confusion in the minds of the people of what the 12th Imam actually stands for, where he is, and what their responsibility is. And obviously, one of the last things would have been the collection of the funds, either to give them directly to the Imam, or in cases to spend that khums money and other funds that would be coming in on areas where the 12th Imam would have permitted those representatives to spend those resources in. So eventually, obviously, as I mentioned, that the fourth representative, his death comes, and coincidentally, it happens on the 15th of Sha'aban, actually, in the year 329, which in our calendar is May the 14th, 941. And this became a turning point because at this point is where the 12th Imam now begins to tell the community that now that this fourth representative has passed away, there will no longer be any connection, any direct connection, any human representation connection between the 12th Imam and the community. Obviously, the 12th Imam, as we talked about in our previous session, he's not hiding in the cave, he's not hiding in the basement in Samarra, he's not on Greenland, he's not in the Bermuda Triangle, he's not anywhere where people claim him to be. But obviously, with the death of the fourth Imam, there is a change in the way that his connection and the way that his interaction comes about with the community. But one of the things that the 12th Imam does is he writes what they call a tawqi, which is like a letter. It's a recommendation or a letter to the community. And we actually have the text of that letter. So I want to present that and just go through a few of the points that the 12th Imam mentions. It's a bit small, so I'll read it out. So this is the letter that he writes to As-Samiri, the fourth representative. He says, O Ali ibn Muhammad Samiri, may Allah increase the reward of your brothers concerning you because of your death. The Imam says to him that death will come to you within the next 6 days. So complete all of your responsibilities and do not nominate any person after you. Obviously nominate to be the representative of the Imam. The sequence of special deputies will come to an end and the major occultation will commence with your demise. Now the reappearance will occur only with the permission of Allah after a prolonged period and after the hearts of the people are hardened and the earth will be filled with corruption. And such a period will emerge on my Shias that people will claim that they have seen me. Whoever makes such a claim before the advent of Sufyani and the heavenly voice, that person is a liar and an impostor. And there is no strength or power save that of Allah the High and the Great. So just 3 points I wish to bring up from this letter. As the 12th Imam himself said, that the sequence of special deputies would come to an end and the major occultation would commence with the demise of As-Samiri. So this shows us two things, that special deputyship has come to a close. Again, because sometimes people like to exaggerate within our community. They say this Marja or that Marja is a direct representative of the Imam. He's, you know, the leader of the Shia world after the Imam. These are just words that we use. There are no validity to them. Yes, again, we respect our maraja, respect the ulama, but we have to ensure that we do not go to extremes in raising their level up, because as history has shown, that this can lead to us missing the true path of Ali Muhammad. And as the 12th Imam says, it also from this point forward is the major occultation. So as we talked about in our last session, that the earlier Imams, even back to the 6th Imam, they had talked about two occultations, the minor and the major. Here the 12th Imam is also showing us that this major occultation would take form. And obviously we don't know when that will be. We'll look at that in later discussions, but even just to give you an example, is that even according to the traditions, even our 12th Imam doesn't know when his ghaibah will end. So he is, you know, we call him with two names, Al-Muntazir and Al-Muntazar. So we are waiting for him and he is also waiting. So he is also waiting for the opportunity to come out of this occultation. And as the 12th Imam also mentioned, he says that now that appearance will only occur with the permission of Allah after a prolonged period and after the hearts of the people are hardened and the earth will be filled with corruption. So this was actually foretold by Rasulullah in Hadith, where he told us, and Shia and Sunni narrate these traditions, where the Prophet would say that Al-Mahdi, for example, is from my family, or he's from the children of Fatima, as the Sunni Hadith narrate. And the Prophet would say that he will come, he would make his advent known after the world had been filled with injustice, oppression, and tyranny. So there is this sense of the state of affairs, the social, economic, political situation of the world will be completely just upside down, right? There will be killings, there will be wars, there will be, and we'll look at this when we look at the signs of the Dhuhr. That is when we expect the time of the 12th Imam to come. And as he says, the hearts of the people will become hardened, right? That there will be no sympathy, no love, no care in humanity on a whole. And then as the 12th Imam says, and such a period will emerge on my Shias when people will claim that they have seen me. And whoever makes such a claim before the advent of Sufyani and the heavenly voice, and just on a side note that, again, we'll look at that more in detail in the future, but there are five signs that will happen before the time of the 12th Imam, five specific signs. You look in the hadith, and we may study those later, but there are certain hadith, for example, there's one very long hadith with the Prophet talking to Salman, and there are maybe 100, 150 signs listed in the hadith. Those, some of them, our scholars say, are definite and indefinite. Some things may happen, some things may not happen. But there are five definite signs, one of them being Sufyani, one of them being this heavenly voice, which is referred to in this tradition, and three other things. But as the Imam says, that whoever claims to have seen me before those five things occur, they're basically a liar and an imposter. And again, that is extremely important for us to keep in mind because of the fact that people have in the past claimed to be Imam Mahdi. Right? In the early 80s, there was an imposter who actually took Masjid al-Haram in Mecca with weapons, with machine guns, and he claimed to be the Mahdi. Eventually, he and his followers were all killed, either hanged or they were killed in the siege of Mecca. In Sudan, there was somebody who claimed to be the Mahdi. Recently, I saw a YouTube video, somebody claimed to be the Mahdi. So there are all of these people who claim this, and they actually attract followers. So that's why I stress on the fact that we have to know the signs, because if we don't know the signs, we see people who speak beautifully, who might have knowledge, who may even do things which might seem supernatural to us. And if we don't know the signs, we may be tricked into believing that these people are the Imam or a representative or a deputy of the Imam, which obviously would impact our own standing on the Day of Judgment. I end with a final quote from Ayatollah Shaheed Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, one of our great scholars. He was killed by Saddam along with his sister just after in the early 1980s. He has a very beautiful quote about what he deems as success in the time of the minor occultation and also the major occultation. And he says the following. He says that the transformation of the minor occultation into the major occultation signifies that the objectives and aims of the minor occultation had been adequately fulfilled. So we have to again study what was the goal of the 12th Imam in the Ghaybat al-Sughra, the minor. One of them was to prepare our minds to have an Imam who is not physically accessible. One of the responsibilities, that was one of the goals of the minor occultation. So he says that because the Ghaybat shifted from the minor to the major, this shows that the minds of the Shias of that time were now ready to accept an Imam who would be finally completely off limits that we could not interact with. Ayatollah Baqir al-Sadr says, this elaborate program protected the Shias from the difficulties arising from the occultation of the Imam. And gradually, they made a mental shift from the special deputies and accustomed themselves to referring to their religious matters to the scholars. So again, it becomes a paradigm shift from having the Prophet, having Amir al-Mu'mineen, having the first 11 Imams, and now having to have a 12th Imam, but a buffer between the Imam and the community, being these representatives. So that 63-year period basically gave the Shias of that time a mental opportunity to accept that, okay, the Imam is now going to be away completely. How do we fulfill our responsibilities? You know, sometimes people ask that, well, why wouldn't Allah just allow the 12th Imam to live on earth, like I talked about last week? Then we could all believe, it would be easy, right? But we know that's not the fact. Because even when Rasulullah was alive, 23 years as the Prophet outwardly, and people still denied him. So just having the Imam physically present in our gathering, in our midst, does not mean that we would necessarily accept him. So then again, there is a wisdom why Allah put this Ghaybat into place. And again, we talked about it last week, and maybe in the future we might discuss it more. But just to end with this last part of the quote, he says, thus the responsibility to represent the Imam in the major occultation again, this is a general representation, not specific, falls upon the just religious jurisprudence, and it becomes obligatory for the people to follow their rulings in worldly as well as religious matters. And so obviously that takes us to where we are today, and where we've been as a community for the past 1,200 years, is where we don't have connection to our 12th Imam directly. We don't meet him, we don't talk to him. Maybe some of you do, I don't. But that is a time where we have connection to the Imam in a general sense, where we have religious problems, we have religious issues in our life that we can't deal with, that we go to the Maraja, the representatives of the Maraja, and have at least the religious aspect of our life sorted out. We end there, and inshallah we will continue in this discussion in the weeks to come and look at other aspects. And we're not, just a very brief review of the minor. We'll go into the major occultation, in which we'll try to look at some of our responsibilities during the ghaybat of the Imam. And also we'll tie into some of the hadith that look at the signs. Again, there are many different signs mentioned in the hadith, and we need to study and analyze them to be sure that when those signs do appear, that we are knowing that the time of the Imam would become imminent. And obviously nobody knows, as even we see in the dua of Ahad that we recite, where we say, إِنَّهُمْ يَرَوْنَهُ بَعِيدًا وَنَرَاهُ قَرِيبًا, that this return of the Imam is something which we might think to be far away, but Allah says, وَنَرَاهُ قَرِيبًا, that we see this as something near, something close at hand. And obviously we don't know when it will happen, but we have to all be preparing for the Imam. We have to prepare ourselves, our family, our spouses, our children, our community, and even society on a whole to welcome the 12th Imam. We close and we ask Allah to give us all the ability to know our Imam, that we are able to recognize our responsibility to Imam al-Hujjah, and that if his dhuhr takes place during the time of our life, that we are able to give all of our support and assistance and all of that we can to the Imam of our time. Rabbana taqabbal minna innaka anta as-sami'ul 'alim. Let us close by remembering the deceased from our families, our communities, our friends, the ulama and the shuhada, with a surah al-mubarakatul fatiha. But before that, one salawat upon Muhammad.